want to make sure that I am where I think. Okay.
Yes. Okay. So what I'd like you to do is start with your pathway into the field of addiction research and give me a little bit of a sense of where you were coming from and whether you had had any previous encounter with addicted persons or with academic training in substance abuse, either alcohol or drugs.
Where do you want to start in our backgrounds? Like going to graduate school?
Yeah. Did you have any previous experience or training prior to grad school?
Not specifically related to the addictions. No, I had some practical research assistant experience in operant behavior and behavior analysis. So as I went to undergraduate school at the University of Maryland, that was a pretty strong operant stronghold. Joe Brady had affiliations there. Lou Golub was there, who was an operant conditioner. Other people who were, it was a strongly operant program. Jack Finley had affiliations there. I think during my last year, I worked as a research assistant at the Institute for Behavioral Research, which was actually doing some psychopharmacology work. I wasn't directly involved with it, but I also got experience there working in a large primate colony in a social arrangement where animals could move around freely, somewhat freely, and occasionally go to a work chamber within the social environment and work on operant tasks.
A group housed,
yeah. Well, it was sort of a mixture. It was like they had little apartments, and they could leave the apartment and go down to the social area.
Yeah.
And then they'd come back through what was called the entry chamber and cue in their personal ID that would unlock their apartment door to go back to the individual chamber.
So it was really that experience.
I think that was the beginning of my real behavior analysis scientific experience and interest. Jack Finley was there doing some drug work at that time. So one of the things I had a little bit of exposure to, seeing some experiments going on where Jack had trained, were they baboons or rhesus monkeys? I'm not sure. But large primates to stick their arm out through a little hole to receive injections.
Hmm.
Pretty fascinating stuff.
Yeah, yes. Huh. So that was more Jack Finley than Joe Brady, who was an influence in your undergraduate degree?
That was really both of them. Probably more so Joe. I had a seminar with Joe. Neither of them were really strong influences or personal contacts at that time. In the sense of having a bunch of direct contact, but they, in hindsight, were sort of influential, and then the little bit of contact I had with them was memorable, and it came to play a role later on.
Yes. Yes. And what do you think attracted you to that kind of work?
Well, at the time, I decided to become a psychology major and really sort of stumbled on this opportunity to work in the psychology research field. I'd originally started as an undergraduate in an engineering program, and moving into psychology, I gravitated toward the more quantitative hard science side of psychology. And so this was pretty appealing. And this, the whole notion of behavior analysis is often characterized as behavioral engineering also. It was given this technical label.
Ah, that's an interesting point. And were you aware, even as an undergraduate, that there was a kind of paradigm shift happening, that behaviorism was, or experimental analysis was a paradigm shift?
I don't think I was aware it was a paradigm shift. I could tell that within the University of Maryland department it was prominent, and within the stuff I got exposed to, it really seemed to have a remarkable strength in being able to both explain and demonstrate control over behavior in ways that sort of convinced you the explanatory mechanisms had some truth to them when you could apply them, and they had an influence. So then when I went to graduate school at the University of Minnesota, I went there in a social psychology program, which I think reflects my ignorance about all of psychology, because those folks, it turns out, weren't really amenable to operant approaches to behavior at all.
Most of them.
The people I was working with were very cognitive, and And when I first went, I made an affiliation with another faculty member in the department who did some operant work, and my first term was doing a little independent research project with him.
And who was he?
That apparently offended the people in social psychology that I'd made this operant lab affiliation. And then in my second year, I transferred from social psychology into experimental psychology. And I think largely by fortuitousness, was able to get a research assistant job with Travis Thompson in the psychiatry research unit. And Travis had trained with Joe Brady and Jack Findlay back at the University of Maryland.
Wouldn't that have maybe had something to do with it?
Well, he's certainly one of the reasons I sought him out, as I knew about the work they'd done at Maryland, and knew that he was an operant psychology person. I went hunting around for second-year positions. I sought him out. Mm-hmm. And so my background in the primate social chamber and at IBR in general was a strength in my application.
Absolutely.
And
what was he like? What was working with him like?
He was a wonderfully creative, supportive person. I think he was one of the early training program directors in psychopharmacology.
He fairly hands-off?
I would say he was fairly hands-off, yeah. And during my time there, he took a one-year sabbatical, too, so that was especially hands-off. He was gone. And during that time, I worked more with Roy Pickens.
Who was at that time a faculty postdoc?
I think when I entered, I believe he had become a brand new faculty member. He had just recently completed his postdoc with Travis and was a new faculty member. So in my years there, I think I was probably overlapping his first couple years as a faculty member. And it was probably during my second or third year there that Travis was away and Roy was the primary lab director.
Mm-hmm. And so what kind of work did you start doing with him?
Initially, Travis had me working on a Siamese fighting fish project that he was also, in addition to his operant work and his addiction work, he was interested in ethology, basic innate animal behavior. And we were looking at whether opportunities for Siamese fighting fish to do an aggressive display to a model would function as a reinforcer. I think I just stayed with that for a few months. And a position became available in the primate lab, which was another social chamber arrangement similar to the one I worked on at IBR, where a couple of monkeys, these were rhesus monkeys, were in a large social chamber and could periodically go key in their personal identifier and go into a workroom and work on some operant task. And the task in that study was to look at whether morphine would function as a reinforcer in sort of a free-ranging social environment, addressing the issue of whether the basic animal models of drug self-administration that Travis and Schuster had worked out in the University of Maryland were really an artifact of animals being constrained in a small sterile environment with nothing else to do except take morphine every once in a while. Mm-hmm. So one of the reinforcers in the social environment, and the monkeys had radio control backpacks connected to morphine pumps, just to go into one of the rooms and work for morphine reinforcement.
And those backpacks, are they like what? Who sort of invented those, or how did they come into being? They were in wide use at that point?
They were not. I think Travis's lab was the only place that had this completely portable radio-controlled backpack. Other labs that were doing drug self-administration work used what are called tethered animals, mm-hmm. where they might wear a vest to protect them from being able to pick at things.
Like at Michigan.
They'll be fastened to a wall someplace, and the line is running through a protected cable to the vest and into an intravenous location. And the free-ranging monkeys, they weren't tethered to anything. They were just wearing a little leather vest with a little metal box on the back that could have the pump radio controlled.
Mm-hmm. So you think that Thompson figured those out, or who figured
I out think he did that, yeah.
Yeah.
Because it was built internally in the lab there.
Yes.
It was... It looked homemade.
Yeah. All right. So,
And I worked on other operant projects in the laboratory at that time. And Travis also got, during my postdoc, I guess, got some of... He was then becoming interested in developmental disabilities and the application of behavioral principles to treatment of retardation.
Mm-hmm. So he was already at that point moving... towards that and away from addiction?
I don't think he was so much moving away from. He was just doing more.
Mm-hmm.
Initially it wasn't evident that there was a move away from addiction, but in hindsight, it was the beginning of that. But he was beginning his developmental disabilities work with an affiliation with a state hospital and got a number of us involved as consultants there to try to improve the quality of care by applying behavioral principles. Mm-hmm. Roland Griffiths and I began
yes.
working.
That was the behavioral
around.
Modification consulting that you did at
yeah.
the hospital.
Yeah.
And what kinds of things did that entail?
Well, it was some of the first, for me and Roland, I guess it was some of our first applications of behavioral principles to real-world clinical problems.
Mm-hmm.
That we were consulting with staff and designing teaching programs, arranging structured regimens within the residential facilities to both to provide teaching and to provide recreational opportunities in ways that would both maintain good behavior, maintain rewarding environments for the participants, and generally trying to make things better for both the residents and the staff.
Yeah. So is that where you did the single study chronic alcoholism?
Oh, the single case. Not,
yeah, the single subject.
Somewhere along there, and I'm forgetting the exact sequence. I think it was while Travis was gone. The single case alcoholism study was done with Roy Pickens, and I think that was the beginning of Roy's first involvement with human work. Also,
mm-hmm. So both of yours.
He began to do some sort of case study, individual case kind of combination, therapeutic research work. With patients from the psychiatry service.
So that was from that hospital?
That wasn't at the state hospital. That was back at the university hospital.
Okay.
Yeah, that was within the psychiatry department. And the state hospital was separate from the university, a state facility about 60 or 70 mm-hmm. miles south.
Okay. And at that time, how aware were you of the state of the field, of knowledge in the field of addiction research?
That's a hard question to answer. I certainly knew that a lot of work was going on with the development of drug self-administration technologies mm-hmm. and the application of behavior analysis and behavioral principles to understanding drug actions. Early on, Travis and Schuster were writing their introductory textbook on behavioral pharmacology, and the students were sort of, using the drafts of that as a textbook and courses and seminars. And the work we were doing ourselves was applications of behavioral principles to understanding drug effects and drug reinforcement. There was some familiarity with the methods of the Addiction Research Center.
When would you say?
I think around then, I think a pretty superficial understanding then, and frankly, I think it was probably viewed somewhat skeptically by people from a rigorous operant background. They were giving drugs to people and asking them what they thought of it and not using any operant principles. I think it was really later, certainly after I moved to Hopkins, that I really developed an appreciation for the quality of that work and the orderliness of those types of measures and that whole methodology for assessing drug effect. I always thought that one of the remarkable things over the course of the transition from doing animal laboratory work to doing human work was to largely but not completely, abandon the most rigorous operant methods and to adopt, to a substantial degree, self-report measures as an index of drug effects in humans. It turns out it's very orderly data. And we continue to use operant behavior procedures along with it. But the recognition of the quality and orderliness of the data, as well as the development of computer technology that allowed us to conveniently collect and summarize and look at a lot of self-report data, the things that I think went together early on in the early 70s when Roland and I were working together at probably what was then called Baltimore City Hospitals, doing our first human operant work. We started off trying to be rigorous operant conditioners and having people pull levers and ignoring, to a large extent, opportunities to ask people to provide self-report information. And we didn't have confidence in self-report as a useful measure. And when we did try to do things like that, we quickly found ourselves overwhelmed with more pieces of paper than we could conveniently look at and analyze. Yes. And then with the advent of personal computers, where all the questionnaires could be put on the computer, and instead of having to sort through and score things, you get a nice orderly spreadsheet of summary data at the end. It suddenly became a domain of data that could be really conveniently collected and managed and analyzed and appreciated.
I'm going to ask you to talk about the Addiction Research Center inventory a bit later, but let's go to Baltimore, the work that you were doing when you first went to Baltimore.
I got this nice job offer. The Hopkins job is really the only job I've had after my postdoc. So I did my graduate work in Minnesota. I stayed on there and did a postdoc, began doing some human work, and then began looking for a job that would allow me to continue doing behavioral pharmacology. And at the time, I would like to do both animal and human work, and had no realization that doing both things might be difficult. And then got this nice job offer from Baltimore to go and split my time between animal work and human work. The animal laboratory was with Joe Brady and Jack Findlay at the medical school campus, and the human lab was with Lou Falaise in an alcohol research center at the Baltimore City Hospitals campus. And Ira Liebson was the medical director of the behavior unit, and Mimi Cohen was the primary research psychologist with the group. So I initially was dividing my time between the two. I think I only divided my time for about somewhere between 1 and 2 years, maybe a year and a half, before I switched over completely to human work. Frankly, I think I never got really engaged in the animal lab work that Jack was doing. And in hindsight, I'm not sure really why that happened. I think that was some of that was around the time that Jack Findlay was deteriorating a little bit in his professional commitment and performance. Now, I don't think I realized it at the time, but in hindsight, it might have contributed to my not really getting engaged with that work. But the human work was just fascinating. Ira Liebson and Mimi Cohen had really done what I believe is the very first work with human drug self-administration, where they manipulated environmental conditions and showed that you could exert control over human drug taking, or in this case, human alcohol self-administration, that it was an operant behavior that was influenced by environmental conditions and could be used as an outcome measure. The other folks who up to that time had done work in these types of residential laboratories with alcoholism hadn't really viewed drinking as an outcome variable in the sense of something that you could exert control over and manipulate. They would study it descriptively. But Ira and Mimi had begun changing the schedules of reinforcement, varying the work requirement, varying the consequences of drinking versus non-drinking, and showed that this disorder that was characterized by being in the popular and I think in the scientific mind as being uncontrollable and out of control, as being something that was very much controllable and amenable to influence by environmental conditions.
So what's a residential laboratory? What did that look like? How was it? Can you describe it to me?
Well, looking back, it looked old and beat up, but I forget if it was like that at the time or whether it's just looking back in hindsight. But it was not in one of the primary acute hospital areas of the hospital. So it probably was in a more rundown, older building. It was set up as a couple of shared bedrooms with two or three people per room, and a dormitory style, and then a large day room area in which social and recreational opportunities were available, and it was overseen by a central nurses station. In that description of the general layout, it's the kind of design we've stayed with for 30-some years. It's a great system.
And how does it, tell me why.
Because we wanted to conduct fairly long-term studies in which individuals serve as their own controls and are exposed to a variety of conditions, and that requires that people stay in residence for a long time. So you need to have a comfortable living environment. Typically, we're not doing work with medically ill volunteers, but medically healthy volunteers who are generally healthy and ambulatory and need to have a comfortable living environment. So the day room setting where there are recreational opportunities provides a comfortable and acceptable way for people to live for prolonged periods of time. The central nurses station provides a way to monitor and ensure the safety and well-being of everybody, as well as to collect data about what's going on in the general social environment.
And how does data collection work?
It's varied a lot. Some of those early studies we were doing time sampling procedures of a signal would come on and nurses would watch volunteers for a few moments and characterize what they were doing, whether they were engaged in recreation, whether they were engaged in social activities. Sometimes they were controlling those things so that depending on what the volunteer had done, they would be enforcing that they're sitting in a particular location and either engaging or not engaging in recreational or social activities. So,
and at that point, what would you say that your main research questions, right? You use this setup to answer what kinds of questions?
I think we were still laying the initial kind of groundwork and understanding that alcohol intake and alcohol self-administration are controllable by and influenced by environmental conditions. So I think our focus was on what we perceived at the time to be powerful social reinforcement processes that seemed to co-occur with and apparently reinforce and maintain alcoholic drinking. Mm-hmm. So we showed that when people were drinking, they engaged in more social activity. When they were drinking, they engaged in more cigarette smoking. So as consequences of the alcohol administration, they were doing other things that looked like they generated more reinforcement, more reward. It just gave them just an overall better consequence outcome to to their choices.
When did you begin to get away from the sort of strict operant conditioning? When did you start to want to ask them or about what their experiences were like?
I don't think I know the answer to that.
Right now I can't think of a transition time.
So, let's see. Trying to think of a better way to ask the question, but at some point, were you always using the ARCI?
No.
When did you start using that?
I'm not sure I'm right, but it might be that we began doing that when the ARC group moved to Baltimore.
And you had more sort of interchange with them?
Right, we actually started talking to these folks.
Yeah. So that would have been when would you say? Early 80s or late 70s?
We probably began talking with them in late 70s. Their lab was set up and running and giving its progress reports as being from the Baltimore site in 82. Mm-hmm. And I forget exactly when they closed the Lexington facility, but when they had stopped using prisoners and were looking for places to move to, which would be in the late 70s, Roland and I visited Kentucky and talked with them about the possibility of their moving to Baltimore.
Oh, you went there?
Yeah.
Oh, can you describe that trip?
As I recall, a one-day trip where we went out on the same day. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we saw the whole Lexington facility. I think they had already been disallowed from using prisoners in research. So I think we were seeing a skeleton arrangement.
The animal lab, maybe, still going?
I don't remember visiting the animal lab at that time. It's possible we did, but not prominent in my memory. Okay. I think the real issue for the Lexington people was not that we were looking at them, but that they were wanting to get information from us about the prospects of their being able to prosper in Baltimore.
Yes.
So the fact that we had experience doing human drug self-administration research and working with an IRB for getting approval and could describe the environmental context of being able to recruit substance abuser volunteers from the community. That's something they were unfamiliar with and very afraid of. They had been for, 40 years or so, dependent on a literally captive population for doing their work. And I think they had a lot of doubts and concerns of whether their methodologies could be transferred over to working with a truly volunteer population who could walk out and could choose not to have anything to do with them if they chose to. So I think the main purpose of that mission, that visit, was for them to get somewhat reassured by us and from us that you can do human clinical pharmacology work in Baltimore, in this institution and in this urban setting, and both get the regulatory approvals and the volunteer participation and cooperation.
And would you have particularly met with Don Jasinski or others as well?
I'm thinking somebody else was the lead person. Bill Martin probably would have been the overall.
Still
I'm sure Bill Martin was the overall ARC director at that time. My memory is that he chose to retire rather than move to Baltimore.
Yes.
So I think he stayed director right up until everybody else moved out, and he dissociated himself at that time.
Right. So what do you remember about him? Anything?
The I've never had a lot of contact with Bill Morton, but I've seen his meetings and things, and he's always been a very impressive, remarkably knowledgeable and diverse guy. So he's always a just an impressive individual. Mm-hmm.
So at the time that you went to Lexington, do you think that by then you had sort of moved to appreciating the quality of their work and the orderliness of, their data by then? Or
I think so, mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's probably when they came, then we began doing some collaborative work with them. And again, I'm not sure the exact sequence of things, but I think fairly early on we began doing some of the clinical trial work with buprenorphine. Mm-hmm. So one of the things they brought with them was connections to new drugs and to the pharmaceutical industry and to the medications development field in a way that we had not really had before. Mm-hmm. And in particular, they brought access to buprenorphine. Don had been working with buprenorphine and had published the first paper suggesting it could be useful in addiction treatment. One of the studies we got engaged with them collaboratively on fairly early was a couple different studies that I think Warren Bickel ended up being the primary author on, evaluating buprenorphine in comparison to methadone in one study, and evaluating a range of doses of buprenorphine in an opioid challenge situation, mm-hmm. in another.
Yes. All right.
So with those studies, I'm sure at that point we were using some of the ARC type methodologies. As to whether we had adopted them before those studies or not, that's what I don't really remember. Mm-hmm. Those two studies are the ones that I recall as being, the primary beginnings of the use of that methodology, the collaboration with them, and the incorporation.
Okay, let me
of
ask you
methods in our studies.
What did you have to do, almost intellectually, in order to make that kind of move from a heavily operant approach to a, how would you even call it, less, more mixed?
Self-report.
Self-report, okay.
Using self-report data. Mm-hmm. I think the critical thing was just seeing the orderliness of the data.
Mm-hmm. So just becoming convinced.
Basically, yeah, that this is really measuring something meaningful and informative. Mm-hmm. And in some of our studies, we would incorporate both, where we would use operant methods as well as self-report methods to compare the abuse liability of different drugs. I think the one I'm remembering is one that Roland was first author on, comparing pentobarbital and one of the benzodiazepines, probably diazepam, that included both operant choice methodologies as well as self-report methods. Mm-hmm. And so one of the themes for a while was that you need to continue, while it looks like there's good correspondence between operant measures of reinforcing potency and self-report estimates of reinforcing potency, you need to continually cross-validate every once in a while. Mm-hmm. And so we did some studies in which we used both methods and said, look at that, they provide comparably orderly data telling you, leading to the same conclusions.
So did that lessen your, would you have described yourself as skeptical of self-report data?
Oh, sure, sure. I think the operant psychology training, I think, very directively led students to be skeptical of self-reports, mm-hmm. In ways that in hindsight seem kind of humorous. Because social systems couldn't function at all if there wasn't some truth to what people said. we wouldn't have been able to get here for this meeting if we hadn't been able to agree that we were going to do that. But the early operant training, for a reason I don't now understand, really just very directly led people to believe you can't believe what people say.
Can I move up to 4 instead of 3:30?
I think so.
Okay, because I think Roland's coming in at 4:45 or something.
That's what I'm hoping.
Okay, I'll be here at 4.
Okay, all right.
Sorry. Good.
That's okay. He's not going to be able to control himself. He can't limit himself in the amount that he talks.
That's off the record, Elaine. he actually goes off the record more than anyone else I've ever interviewed. But, you know, he's got great stuff.
Oh, he's a wonderful talker. And a wonderful person, not just a talker, but he does have wonderful ways of presenting things.
I'm trying to get at this, this operant. It must be just, in a sense, the strength of the belief. I call them structures of belief in my own writing. Mm-hmm. So that structure of belief, which is very, you clearly, when you entered the field, right, that was an ascendant, if not the dominant paradigm in the field, right?
The verbal was.
Yeah, right. And so you guys come in, but you become almost, there must have been some sort of almost charismatic quality to that system.
To the operant system.
You became extremely convinced.
It's probably the case that Freudian-type verbal psychology was the dominant force, and psychodynamic psychology was the popular dominant force in psychology through the 50s. Mm-hmm. And then operant psychology got introduced as a technology and a science that went beyond some of this funny-sounding, sometimes unbelievable stuff that seemed to be the dominant explanatory force, and was presented as a technology and as an engineering approach that was using objective measures of behavior and objective manipulations that could not just explain things but demonstrate causal mechanisms by manipulating things and showing that something changed. It's like, again, the engineering analogy, you turn the switch, the light comes on, you've really learned something about mechanisms. And the predominant verbal explanatory stuff of Freudian psychology and psychodynamic psychology seem not to offer any handles to actually demonstrate that it had identified the right causal mechanisms to influence anything.
Right. When you began to think about drug abuse, about addiction, would you say that Freudian and psychoanalytic and psychodynamic approaches that there was a stranglehold over the problem of addiction specifically?
I don't know about a stranglehold. That might be a little strong. But certainly various kinds of cognitive interpretations of, I guess, both cognitive and biological interpretations of addiction were dominant. And the overwhelming notion in among the public, the professionals, and the textbooks was that there had to be something wrong with individuals in order for them to be drug addicted. So I think one of the really transformative things about the understanding of addiction was the development of animal drug self-administration models, where any individual organism, seemingly perfectly healthy and normal, taken down off the shelf and exposed to the right conditions of drug availability, demonstrate that drugs function as reinforcers in pretty much the same pattern as with humans. I think that just undermines the whole notion that there needs to be some psychiatric abnormality in individuals to make them vulnerable. So the development of that animal drug self-administration methodology was really undermining the dominant view of addictions. Mm-hmm. And the nature of the animal models, setting up operant procedures, it just seem so clear that this is an instance of drugs functioning as reinforcers, and people began to work from that perspective. If we look at these as disorders that are produced by the arrangement of contingencies, maybe this will give us something that not only that we can use in an explanatory way, but are going to be sufficiently explanatory that we can do something with the knowledge that will be beneficial.
Mm-hmm. And then as people who come from that operant background come into the field of drug addiction, mm-hmm. into, say, CPDD, what was your experience with those first encounters with mm-hmm. the field?
Well, CPDD used to be a small organization, and everybody would get together in one room and have the meeting. It's long enough ago, I don't really remember the content of the meeting, but I do remember that the International Study Group Investigating Drugs as Reinforcers, ISCADAR, developed as an outgrowth and a satellite to CPDD because of the feeling that this operant approach to viewing drugs as reinforcers was not getting enough floor time, that the dominant content of the meeting was other perspectives and approaches to
was
addiction.
That your feeling at the time? Did you share that view?
I was too young and ignorant at that time to have that perspective, I think. But I certainly enjoyed going to the ISCADAR meetings, so they were recognized as a good, high-quality content area for folks looking at drugs as reinforcers. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I had enough perspective to myself recognize that it was an outgrowth that resulted from people feeling unappreciated mm-hmm. in the main
meetings. So you came in after ISCADAR had essentially been established?
That's something I'm not 100% sure of what that timing was. I think that I certainly wasn't involved in the starting up of ISCADAR. It may already have existed, and what I'm remembering is that the forum for the drug self-administration work was the satellite, not the main body of the meeting. And mm-hmm. people always thought it was good when you can get some operant paper presented in the main meeting, but people would come to CPDD with the expectation that there wasn't going to be much of that in the main program, but we'd get to talk to one another in the ISCADAR satellite session.
Mm-hmm. And at some point, it must have become apparent that that was becoming a more dominant view within the organization. When do you think the sort of tipping point would have been?
I'm not sure there was a tipping point. I think it has been very gradual. There's certainly been a successful incorporation of operant methodologies all through the drug abuse field. But ISCADAR hasn't gone away either. It's still a nice high-quality meeting that participates as a satellite of this meeting and brings in a core of people who are really interested specifically in that methodology and perspective. Mm-hmm. But it's been gradual over the years that the effectiveness of drug self-administration methods and operant approaches in general has just become so widely recognized that it been absorbed into and adopted by pretty much all the fields. It's a commonplace for people who are really neurobiological neuroscientists just to incorporate animal drug self-administration operant methodologies with a progressive ratio procedure into their studies without thinking of themselves at all as having any interest in operant behavior. And in fact, not having any interest in operant behavior, just having come to recognize this is one of the tools, just as though you might be measuring blood pressure, you use operant behavioral methods to measure behavior.
Yeah. How do you talk about, then, the relationship between neuroscientific approaches to addiction and behavioral pharmacological approaches? How would you describe that relationship?
Well, there's in many areas there's a lot of close interaction between the two. They've come to blur and interact quite successfully. To characterize the distinctions, I think the behavioral pharmacological emphasis is on what I guess I would call macro determinants of behavior, sort of larger environmental things, and the neurobiological neuroscience approach is on the micro determinants of which particular areas of the brain are involved or which particular transmitter systems are involved.
That's very helpful, actually. Would you say that your work then over that, I mean, you've been at Hopkins this whole long time, but is your work now still concerned in many ways with similar questions and techniques around sort of macro determinants of behavior? Is that how you would describe what you do?
I think I would, yeah. I've never turned into a neuroscientist. Mm-hmm. So I just don't have the skills and the knowledge to really address the micro determinants of transmitters and molecules in specific regions of the brain.
Nor did you turn into a geneticist.
Sorry, say it again?
A geneticist.
I've come to appreciate the role of genetics more. That's another area. I think the operant field was kind of ardently opposed to and dismissive of. The view was that everything is environmentally determined, and that's just not true.
Yeah.
And so it's been one of the changes over the years that the evidence for genetic determinants of complex behavior and addictions has just become overwhelmingly clear. So everybody has to accept that as part of the given.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you can accept it, but still not have the skills or the technical knowledge or even the particular research resources to allow you to incorporate it into your own work. So the closest we've come in our group, I think, is looking at people with and without positive family histories. So it's a macro marker of the genetic loading. So we're not doing any, in our study, we haven't done any genetic testing, but we've taken the family history as an index that there are some family trees that have got it, whatever this genetic loading is, and other family trees that appear not to have it. And you can compare them in the laboratory. And that kind of examination of differential response to different family trees to the same challenge situation in the laboratory provides a way for others to then begin looking at the more micromolecular or microgenetic correlates and determinants of those differences.
Mm-hmm. Could you explain to me what you mean when you use the language of challenge? What does that mean technically?
It just means administering a drug dose to see what happens. In common use, the word challenge probably has some connotations of it being a big deal. It's very challenging. Mm-hmm. But in pharmacology, it doesn't have that implication. It just means you administer the dose to see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. That's... Okay. So, as you look, how would you... That previous question that I asked about the sort of... your research priorities when you began at Hopkins, have they remained the same priorities, different drugs, or how would you talk about the continuities of your career?
I'd like to believe that something has changed over the years.
Well, I'm going to ask you that question too. So if you could do so what has remained perennial and what kinds of changes have you seen in terms of the questions you pose or the ways that you answer them?
Mm-hmm. I haven't thought about this in exactly this way. I think one thing that's happened procedurally is our methodologies have become more rigorous and systematic. Again, one of the traditions of animal laboratory operant psychology was you use very small samples and watch conditions for a period of time until they stabilize, and then whenever you felt like it changed conditions to something else, and watch them for a while. And our early human work was like that, without preset protocols about exactly what was going to be changed when. And we've become more systematic now. We'll lay the studies out that they're going to be a fixed set of conditions in randomized order and specific time points at which everything is going to be changed.
And is that, do you do that in order to sort of meet certain kinds of scientific standards? In other words, is that a field shift?
I think that is a field shift. I think there's been a recognition that the unsystematic ways of oval operant psychology are too prone to the risk of bias about when you might decide to change things. And so we've adopted some more rigorous scientific methods.
Right. You get most of your funding from NIDA?
Yeah.
Any other?
In the past, we've had some alcohol support.
Right.
We probably had some NIH support.
And did when NIDA goes to NIH and there is this concern about research design, did that affect you? Or were you already doing that before?
I'm not aware that NIDA ever went to NIH with concerns about research design.
Okay, that's interesting.
So I don't think I was influenced by, or that our research group was influenced by, anything like that. I think there was just a gradual recognition that that it's just more rigorous to lay things out in advance and follow a fixed protocol. Some of that may derive from exposure to the way pharmaceutical industry studies are designed and run. They work with a degree of rigor that is sometimes surprising to academics.
Yes. So, in a sense, you had to kind of mimic randomized controlled trials, clinical trial design that was occurring outside.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah, when you see it, I mean, it's clear. It's really a better methodology. It just eliminates the self-selection factor that you might have if you haven't specified everything in advance.
Mm-hmm. All right, so that's one major change. Any others that you can think of?
There's certainly been a change in the drugs. The Hopkins Laboratory began as an alcohol research unit, and in the mid-70s, sometime began doing drug work and progressively switched over pretty much completely to drug work, although there's still some alcohol work going on. There's been a progressive move from laboratory-based human pharmacology to applications, and that also began pretty early in the early to mid-70s. The applied therapeutic side has a much bigger role, a proportionate role now than it did early on. It used to be a small role, and now I've never looked at the numbers, but I think of our unit as being about half and half divided between non-therapeutic clinical pharmacology, human laboratory work, and therapeutic trials. I don't know if the numbers would support that, but.
And can you speculate at all as to why?
Part of it is that the motivation for the science at the beginning is to understand something relevant to the clinical disorder. And as you think you know something about the clinical disorder, you you try to intervene and test it in that circumstance. And the nice thing about the operant approach to substance abuse is it really seems to identify things that that give you some handles on something you can do. So the application of operant reinforcement techniques to trying to change drug use behavior in clinical populations seem like a pretty straightforward step.
So let's talk a little bit about clinical research and the changes in that and how they've affected the kinds of questions that you can ask and how you go about answering them.
Are you thinking of the regulatory changes in human research?
Yeah.
Well, overall, everything seems more cumbersome now. And Roland probably talked about this, and I think he feels this frustration more than some people, this feeling that, the work always isn't always as much fun as it used to be, because you can no longer make decisions about things that would be of interest and pursue them and implement the studies regarding them quickly. You've got to spend weeks getting regulatory approval for everything.
So it's, in a sense, delayed the process or...
It slowed the process and also delayed some of the professional reinforcements involved in being a scientist.
That, yes.
One of the appeals of the operant approach is this sort of manipulable, mechanistic view that if you change something, something's going to change. Mm-hmm. And so when people think they have an idea, they would like to implement it and see an effect.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It just can't be done.
I haven't thought about it this way before, but there is something about, well, you behavioral pharmacologists actually take your philosophy or the underlying and apply it to your own work, right? So frequently in these interviews...
Oh, you will say things like, life isn't reinforcing like it used to be.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, very much.
So delayed gratification means something to you that, you know,
think about it as it applies to ourselves and our own behavior.
Yes.
It's an analytic.
And you often have this sort of meta conversation going about your research in those terms. So there's something about the regulatory climate that
makes us perceive ourselves as a rat in a box being manipulated by external circumstances.
Well put. You need say no more. No, that's actually really interesting, because I do think it's interesting the kinds of sort of environmental conditions that and material conditions that shape the kinds of questions that you can ask and how you go about answering them. It's very interesting. Thank you for that. So
what other changes have occurred over time? Talked about that there have been changes in the drugs, changes in the extent to which things have therapeutic direction, changes in the extent to which things are done in the laboratory versus clinical and community settings. So one of the moves has been like with the clinical trials network. Our Hopkins group is the site of one of the nodes of the clinical trials network. So that's involved moving studies into settings that are not even university clinic based, and with their community treatment programs. There's been more move into naturalistic field settings as opposed to ivory tower clinic
yes,
settings.
Yes, right.
In terms of methodology, not sure there's been right now, nothing dramatic changes in methodology. There's been a change in the extent to which people pay attention to things like HIV risk behavior, which used to not be relevant at all, to being something that is a common inclusion in assessments with human studies now.
Mm-hmm. All right, so now I want to ask you some questions about the nature of collaboration and training. So thinking about your that set of professional relationships that you've had over the years that you've done, scientists do collaborative work.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me what factors tend to facilitate long-term scientific collaborations.
Well, personality helps. And having an amiable group of people who get along well with one another has certainly been one of the keys to our unit that we've had.
Is Joe Brady in your unit? Or is he in your unit?
I'm sorry, which he?
Joe Brady.
Or
is he?
No, he was the director of the Division of Behavioral Biology. And frankly, the organization at Hopkins has always been somewhat unclear. Nominally, it seemed like our unit, PPRU, Behavioral Pharmacology Unit, was part of Joe's division, except neither he nor anyone ever did anything to make it seem like it was really part of that division. So there was no reporting,
So you're sort of autonomous.
It's been nice.
Uh-huh.
and that was largely a consequence, I think, of our being on a separate campus with geography. So Joe and the main office and the main what he would view as the main core of behavioral biology was located on the medical school campus, and what we came to call BPRU was located on the what is now called Bayview Medical Center campus. It used to be called Baltimore City.
Right.
Gone through a bunch of names.
So
changes.
I've been to Bayview. Okay, so I understand. And that's where the ARC was also.
Yes.
Or the IRP.
Yeah. Yeah, so their building is right next to our building.
Right. So did that mean that you did become more collaborative with ARC folks? Or IRP folks?
For a while. When Don Chuzinski was there and Ed Johnson was there, we began doing these buprenorphine studies.
Mm-hmm.
And then a number of our people, meaning our postdocs and graduates, have moved over to be IRP.
Right.
ARC of IRP.
Right, so that's kind of thickened the connections a little bit.
Yes. But in recent years, I don't think there's some ties still, but I don't think there's really much active collaboration going on. We just find it kind of administratively difficult to get things done in collaboration with the feds.
Mm-hmm.
So we have some nice professional friendships and interactions back and forth. I would have expected there to be more active scientific collaboration than there is for having two active research groups with somewhat complementary abilities and resources sitting right next to one another.
Right. But you would have had to have a different kind of administrative flexibility in order to make that happen.
Or different individuals involved who just somehow took more effort or were more successful in establishing.
Did their research priorities change? The ARC, IRP, the intramural program did?
Well, their program, I think, changed some. When Jasinski was scientific director, and probably Jaffe, after two of us, filled that role for a while. Schuster might have been in that role then, or maybe it was Pickens. Anyway, for a while there were folks who had significant interest in human research and clinical pharmacology and clinical therapeutics applications. The current director of ARC is a micro-level neuroscientist who's emphasizing molecules and genetics.
Right. So that shift to the micro, to the molecular, is... that takes
a shift.
Yeah, and so you felt that really. I mean, that's not just.
Well, I can just see it as characteristic of their unit. I never have any conversations with the director of the intramural program. He never has any conversations with me. Our approaches to science, and I guess this reflects on our personalities also. We just have it. For whatever reason, taken the effort to really develop a relationship and a collaboration.
Right.
So the the collaborations that go on are, will occur at the individual scientist level.
Right. So in a way, your collaborative work that you do is primarily with Roland, Roy,
Maxine, sort of
within your own group, because that's, those are in a way the most facilitated collaborative relationships.
Right. We have similar viewpoints, similar interests and resources. We get along well, think the same, can sit down and think about how to do studies and talk about the options. And
can you give me an example? Since I, you know, historians function alone in small rooms by themselves. Can you tell me, like, how a, like, take me through a study that the three or four of you do together? Can you kind of walk me through it?
I think if I can think of an example. Well, in some ways, it's easy to start with one of these from long ago, when Jasinski was there and we were getting started with the buprenorphine studies.
Oh, great. I was just going to say, if you could do the buprenorphine one, that'd be great.
I'm not sure how exactly it got initiated, but one of us or both of us or several of us on either side suggested, why don't we talk about doing some more work with buprenorphine? That looks pretty interesting. And so we got together, probably Don and Johnson on their side, and me and Maxine, and probably Warren Bickel, who was a postdoc with us at the time, just to talk about it. So, Don, you know, tell us about this drug.
And was it Don or was it Ed who was more passionate about it?
I think at that time it would be Don that we turned to. And at that time, I don't think I don't think Ed had the scientific prominence that he has now. I don't think he'd really developed his own role within the ARC. He was an assistant to more senior people like Don, who were more prominent. So probably the first time we met, thought of Ed as support staff, and administratively he may have been support staff, and he was assigned to run the pharmacy in the ARC. So I think internally he was kind of given that role too, and I think Don really developed him as an independent scientist. But in the discussions, Ed always has lots to say, so he'd be a real active participant in thinking about what would be worthwhile to do next with this drug. Should we start trying to see if it can be used therapeutically, what would be the right thing to do? And somebody can say, well, we've already got one treatment, so probably we should compare it to what we've already got. And you know, what would be the right setting in which to do that? Should we be doing a laboratory study? Should we be doing a therapeutic study? And has that already done the laboratory studies? We've settled on, we're talking about moving it into treatment. Let's try it in some kind of treatment application. So we settled on the detoxification application as one that I think Don's early data had suggested that buprenorphine might be especially useful as a detox agent by having less of a withdrawal syndrome. So conversations for a while, we've sort of already structured the general experimental design that we want to get some people and randomize them to buprenorphine and methadone. And then we go on to say, what else do we need to figure out? We need to figure out the doses of the two and the dose reduction schedules, and we need to figure out what the measures are going to be. And that's where we would, for those early studies, probably began adopting the ARC methods because they already had in their armamentarium this standard procedure. So they would have been saying, well, of course we'll use the measures we've always used. We've used these measures in opioid studies for 30 years. We're not going to stop now.
So at first, was that, were you a little...
No, I think we were happy with that. I don't think we had any problem with that.
So by then, you had sort of overcome the
recognize that these measures can be okay. And we're talking about using them in a context where they weren't going to be the only measures. So we'd have some objective physiological measures. We'd have, they'd be collecting urine samples and self-reports about drug use. So we'd have other objective outcome measures. And these self-report measures would be interesting things to look at. Sure, we can see what people have to say.
And then how do you, so you've now talked through and you've basically sort of got protocols at that point?
I think at that point we have a general study design. We probably said, Warren, fill in some of the details on that. to work up a timeline for exactly which measures would be done when. And he probably went back and forth a little bit between me and Max on our side and Don and Ed on the ARC side, and came up with a scheme, a schedule, mm-hmm. that everyone agreed on. And then I don't offhand know whether he or one of the faculty people would have drafted the protocol for the IRB. It probably would have been Warren. Mm-hmm. And then it would get looked at by everybody and edited up. And sent in.
And would the IRB at that point be make changes in it? Request changes or?
Typically, no. Mm-hmm. They would ask questions about any issues they had concerns about. Well, you think even now, our IRB doesn't normally change things. Mm-hmm. They ask questions and say yes or no.
Mm-hmm. So you're. I was going to ask you a question about training, because you do an immense amount. You've trained an enormous number of people who become prominent, in fact, mm-hmm. in the field. What do you do?
I usually say that the main thing we do in our training program is allow people to show how productive they can be when they've got access to a bunch of resources, and that is the key to their being able to get resources in the future and demonstrate to others, convince others that they would make good use of resources, which I think is the key to being an efficient, effective scientist. Mm-hmm. If you're going to have resources and not produce with them, then you don't need any.
That's very, all right, so.
People work in collaboration with faculty. Generally, people will come in with some designated faculty member who's going to be their primary mentor. So they've got some lead that you're going to work at least initially and primarily with this one faculty member on some.
And do they tend to do that? Do they stay with that person?
Over the years, people have we've developed a model in which people stay with a primary mentor but develop other projects also. And now a lot of people will work with several different faculty members. And it varies a lot across fellows as to how many different projects they'll work on and how many different faculty members. The most gung-ho active people will get a whole bunch of projects going and work with a bunch of other people and just seem to have no limit to what they can do or what they're willing to put on their plate. And others can do one or two things at a time. And so that's what they do. But people have said that they've appreciated over the years the flexibility to work with other faculty members. So it gives them other information, other perspectives, other models of how people work. Mm-hmm. And so that having worked with multiple faculty members seems to be what the trainees appreciate as the strength of the program. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that emphasis on using resources well is something, I mean, your lab has been extraordinarily generative. Is that the primary reason?
I don't know. We've certainly set up a situation in which the expectation is that people are going to be productive in the sense of producing studies and products and that they're going to work hard, but I would think that other places do the same thing. Compared to some places, we may have emphasized more selection of people from basic behavioral science backgrounds as opposed to clinical backgrounds. So I think one of the things we've tended to emphasize is taking people who come from the animal lab, from behavioral perspective in the animal lab, mm-hmm. And have them adapt and apply those skills to what can be done with humans. And in general, I think those experimental behavioral science people tend to be more more rigorous and more productive than, say, the folks who come from a clinical psychology background. Mm-hmm. And we try to recruit both populations, take the clinical psychology background and teach them how to adopt and apply scientific methods to clinical problems. But that's a harder transition than changing species.
Indeed. So anything I should have asked that I didn't? The only I remember Roland telling me something about, you should ask him about the NASA lab. I know nothing about, so.
I don't think the NASA lab has played a big role, but it was one of the things that the transition from the my transition from splitting my time between animal work and human work to doing all human work, my initial change was to give up the animal lab at Hopkins and begin working on the so-called NASA lab, human lab at Hopkins.
I see.
And that was a self-contained social environment in which several people could live isolated from the outside world. It was sort of it was a Joe Brady project and a Jack Finley project early on,
right.
Too. The idea was to study social behavior of small groups in isolation from the rest of the world. I worked on it up to the point of getting it built and some initial work done.
And how long did it last? Is it still going?
It lasted for a good while. Marion Fishman came to Hopkins and took over working on that after I switched over to the Bayview campus. When we got our first grant, actually it was a contract, we got our first support to begin applying behavioral methods to treatment. I left the medical school campus and had all my work then at the Bayview campus. So then I was dividing my time between the human laboratory and the human therapeutics of what was our first treatment? Treatment Evaluation Project was the name of our first drug abuse therapeutics trial. It was a contract from NIDA to apply operant reinforcement methods and what were then viewed as more interoceptive psychology techniques, relaxation and meditation, things like that, techniques to substance abuse. But the I don't think the NASA environment to me has any prominent
right, role but it was history. It was a, I think he probably meant that it was, because he was talking about maintaining animal human work sort of in a parallel way,
mm-hmm.
and he said that you had gone over to the human side, and maybe he was thinking of the NASA lab as your route to that.
I don't know. It could be that.
Yeah.
There is this analogy that early on I'd work with these social environments for primates, and then I moved to this social environment for human primates.
Yeah, there's a striking similarity between the...
But in terms of the guidance and the pathway of our substance abuse work, I personally felt that the NASA chamber was sort of a dead end, mm-hmm. and that it wasn't a very productive environment in which to do that work.
Substance abuse specific work.
Yeah. That did. there's a contrast between the type of social environment we had at Bayview, the one I described, the big day room area with the dormitory rooms, mm-hmm. and the nursing center right in the middle where they can observe and actually interact with the volunteers, versus the so-called NASA environment where the volunteers are living inside an enclosed chamber and the staff are all outside, mm-hmm. where it's difficult to see what's going on, it's difficult to interact. I found the NASA environment to be more cumbersome, mm-hmm. putting the staff person in the middle where they could see what was going on and do stuff.
Right.
I found to be a much more efficient
yes.
and congenial way to run the social environment.
Yes.
So because of the NASA support, and because of his own interest, Joe really liked this notion of having a self-contained environment where the people are isolated from the experimenters. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But
right.
you only need that if you're going into outer space, and we're not going there with drug abuse. We hope we're not going there with drug abuse.
Well, that's a lovely place to end, though. Thank you very much.
Okay. Yeah, this works.
If you would, just check tracks. Okay, yes. If you would start by telling us something about your pathway into the field and how you found addiction research.
Okay. In the graduate department I was in had a heavy emphasis on working with opiates. And the some of the junior faculty they were recruiting were from areas that had a concentration in other areas of drugs of abuse. So I was sometimes exposed to not only the faculty, but people coming in for interviews, and the department chair was clearly pushing for me to go into the drug abuse research
and
area.
And who was that, and when was it?
It was Naeem Kazan. He was the chairman, and that was at the University of Maryland in the mid-1970s. One of the things that Dr. Kazan had suggested that I do, and I actually took him up on it, was to work as an addiction counselor. So I did volunteer work as an addiction counselor at a place called the Turk House. It's T-U-E-R-K. It was a halfway house for people primarily with alcoholism problems. But it started out with that, but it became a little broader because what we found was most of the people doing alcohol were starting to do other drugs too.
What department were you in?
I was in pharmacology.
And why on earth did your chair suggest that you volunteer in a treatment facility?
I think he thought that we should get a broader sense of addiction and to actually see some of the patients rather than to just look at this from the standpoint of this is what the drug does to the nucleus accumbens, that sort of thing.
Any idea why he came to that realization? Did it come out of his own work, his own background?
You know, I'm really not